Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and it's Friday, so let's jump right into our week in review, as we do every Friday. And to help us do that, I'm joined by Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Tom, great to have you. Good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is WBUR's senior media analyst and professor of communication at BU, John Carroll. Hey, John.
Hey, Anthony.
So let's start with the terrible events in Brussels this week, the terrorist attacks by ISIS on the airport and a metro station that killed more than 30 people and injured at least 230 more. A little bit of news today. Belgian authorities say they arrested three men in Brussels in connection to the attack as the investigation pushed into France, Germany, Spain, and the Netherlands. They also said that one of the two men who blew themselves up at the Brussels airport was a bomb maker who helped make the suicide vests used in the Paris attacks last November. So here's Secretary of State John Kerry in Brussels this morning.
The United States, I want you to know, is praying and grieving with you for the loved ones of those who have been very cruelly taken from us, including Americans, and for the many who were injured in these despicable attacks.
Now, at least two Americans were killed in those attacks. So, Tom, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts about this latest terrible event in Brussels?
Well, of course, my first thought is that what we need to do is build a really huge wall on our borders.
Of course.
Of course. So I think two things. One is to understand that in Belgium, what is different than the United States? Mm-hmm. And the United States assimilates people, including Muslims, who come into the United States, and they become part of our culture, as opposed to what's happened in Belgium, where you really have these separate enclaves where an us-versus-them mentality develops. I think if there's anything we can do domestically to fight terrorism and the possibility of terrorism, it is to only reemphasize our approach and our focus on assimilation. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing to do is to realize that you need to go and look at why it is ISIS started in the first place, and that is because of a failed state. And you can actually trace that back to the U.S. actions in Iraq. And it is critical, I think, in terms of our foreign policy and whoever's elected the next president to understand that you need to have strong states in the Middle East and that we cannot be an actor who comes in and undermines a state and then leaves chaos behind.
Mm. John, Tom touched on a lot there, and I'm struck in particular by the first point, this idea that these concentrations of very poor Muslims, like in the Molenbeek neighborhood in Brussels, are sort of a breeding ground for this kind of thing. We don't have that issue in this country, as Tom said, but to the extent that our fate is linked with the fates of the Europeans, how can we help them?
Well, Belgium has a particular situation with Arabs and Muslims because they brought a lot of them in the 50s and 60s as cheap labor for factories. Most of those factories are gone now. And so the unemployment rate, especially among the young, is skyrocketing in Belgium. I think it's 23% unemployment among the young, twice the rate among Muslims as among native Belgians. So what you've got is an economic issue, for one thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing you have is a shift in the strategy of ISIS, I think. ISIS has sort of run out of room in Syria and Iraq in terms of taking over territory. In fact, they've lost territory. What they're doing now, I think, is looking to Europe to try to weaken the coalition through terrorist acts, generate overreactions to help in recruiting. And this is a whole new front that's causing all kinds of situations for Europe. One is the whole open borders policy, whether they want to retain that or not. It's got overtones for the Brexit vote in the UK, whether they're going to exit the European Union. You know, one of the watchwords for staying in the European Union was security. You know, now it's the opposite. So, so there are all kinds of repercussions from this, but it really seems to be an organized new front in the war that ISIS is waging.
Well, speaking of that, I want to go back to something John Kerry said this morning. I mean, he said despite this latest attack that the U.S. And its allies are defeating ISIS, rolling back its territory, killing its leaders, restricting its finances. And in fact, today the Pentagon said it killed ISIS's finance minister, Abdelrahman Mustafa el-Kaduli, who's considered the group's number two leader. But Tom, I mean, it seems hard to sort of digest this message that ISIS is getting weaker on the ground when we've got attacks in Brussels, Paris, Istanbul, San Bernardino, and elsewhere.
I think that's exactly right. And the problem is that we kill off a number two guy, and then the number three guy just moves up and becomes the number two guy. It does not seem as if there's a lack of recruits into ISIS. And I think this goes back to the point I was making. And to really tie into what John was saying, you have fertile ground out there for people who are disaffected. They are unemployed or underemployed. They are marginalized within whatever society they are. And something like an ISIS or an al-Qaeda comes along and it becomes very attractive to them because it is such a failure of an existing state.
Yeah. The other part of the recruitment, if I could just add,
sure,
is that what the European security forces are doing now is basically arresting people and asking questions second. And I think that that is also a recruiting tool for ISIS. This idea that every Muslim is suspect or guilty until proven innocent is something that is going to further alienate the community. And I think that it's only going to exacerbate the problems.
Go ahead.
And by the way, let's talk about the United States in terms of the current political campaign on that. Particularly on the Republican side, you had both Trump and Cruz reacting as if every Muslim is guilty.
Cruz talking about patrolling Muslim neighborhoods.
Right.
I'm not even sure what that means. Where are these Muslim
neighborhoods? Neither is he. Yeah.
We're not even sure where those neighborhoods are,
exactly.
But I think they already have police patrols there, so I'm not sure what he's talking about.
Right.
But obviously what he's doing is trying to out-Trump Trump in terms of this sort of anti- or xenophobic attitude we're taking towards people of a particular religion.
Well, speaking of the threat here in the U.S., we spoke with Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating this week. He's a senior member on both House Foreign Affairs and Homeland Security Committees, and he told us that the top threat remaining here in the U.S. is from homegrown terror. Here's what he said.
In San Bernardino, for instance, ISIS did it in an inspirational way. They inspired action for a homegrown type of terrorist, and that's what we face for our primary concern in the U.S. still. That's that greatest threat if you're going to put a ranking on them.
So homegrown, the sort of lone wolf phenomenon. Do you agree with that? And if so, John, is the U.S. doing enough to confront that threat?
I think it's difficult to confront the lone wolves. I think that because they're operating as individual units, it's hard to track them, harder to track them than a cell, for instance. But I think that also the idea that you can actually monitor people to that degree, that you can anticipate these kinds of events, is very difficult. And this is where the trade-off comes between security and civil liberties.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the issues here that doesn't seem to be as prevalent in Europe, at least right at this moment, is a sense that there's a line we don't want to cross in terms of violating people's civil liberties. And I think that that can be that could be make it more difficult in many ways to do the kind of security protection that people are asking for and that the government wants.
Yep, there's always going to be, there will always be soft targets. Well, we should switch gears, bring this conversation back a little bit closer to home. There's some local news today that I want to talk about the future of fantasy sports sites such as FanDuel and Boston-based DraftKings. So this afternoon, Attorney General Maura Healey released new regulations, including restrictions on advertising to minors, protections for inexperienced players, and a ban on players under the age of 21. So here's Maura Healey speaking to reporters this afternoon.
Problem addictive behavior, addictive play, is particularly pernicious for young people. That young people are very susceptible to addictive gaming, addictive play, and so it is all the more important that we take this action and make sure that play doesn't start until age 21.
So a statement from DraftKings announced that it will fully comply with the final regulations. In the statement, it said the regulations put forth today are tough, but we will comply. We will continue to work with policymakers across the country to ensure that fantasy contests are fun and fair. What do you think, Tom Keene, of the Attorney General's approach?
So this is a big win for DraftKings. And as soon as DraftKings tells you this is really tough but we'll fully comply, it means that we're really happy with what just happened.
Right. I mean, because they're not being put out of business.
Completely. Yeah. Completely. I mean, they're being told, okay, so you can't have kids under 21. Fine. That still leaves a huge market for them. And we can't have college sports. Fine. They got basically everything they asked for in here. This is kind of akin to, you know, the last administration's proposal and regulations for Uber, which were a huge win for Uber because it finally says Uber can exist. This is just the same thing for DraftKings.
Hmm. Do you see this as a big win, John, for DraftKings?
I see it as a reasonable win for DraftKings. I think there are some things in here that are going to be problematic for them that are not getting as much attention. There's a $1,000 limit per month for players, and that's going to be something that's going to hold down their revenues and the action. There's also the banning of what they call scripts, which are the software programs that allow the people who win most of the money on DraftKings and FanDuel, the other big fantasy sports company. You know, these are the programs that give them the algorithms to pick the teams that are going to generate the most revenue for the players. So I think how they define those and actually how that is actually adjudicated is going to be critical for DraftKings. I don't think that this is a 100% win for them, because I think that there are some things to be ironed out down the road that may be detrimental to the business.
I'm curious if this decision in Massachusetts to go in this direction, what kind of impact it will have elsewhere in the country, because these companies are facing shutdown orders in other states. Does this provide a sort of middle of the road model that is reasonable regulations, or Tom, as you see it, a big win for these companies? But what do you think? Is this going to have an impact elsewhere in the country?
Well, obviously, where the attention is going to be focused is going to be on New York,
right,
which has adopted exactly the opposite attitude of Maura Healey. Healey went forward and tried to see how can we make this legal, and she's come out with clearly making this legal. That's not the case in New York. There's a court case coming up. Meanwhile, the online fantasy gambling have shut down their business, basically. They won't take money. They'll just do it for play. I think New York is still going to go all the way to a court case. It may, however, have an influence on the assembly in New York in terms of saying, this is a big business. We shouldn't just be the state that somehow, you know, prohibits it while everybody else allows it.
Well, let's move on from legalized sports gambling to the possibility of legal recreational marijuana here in Massachusetts. This November, Bay State voters will very likely have a chance to decide on recreational use. Massachusetts State Senator Jason Lewis, who chairs the Special Senate Committee on Marijuana, studied the issue for a long time. This week, we talked to him about his decision to come down against legalizing pot in the Bay State. Here's what he said.
Opening the door to legalization will no doubt send a message that marijuana is safe. It will likely lead to more young people, even more than today, using the product. And opening the door to a commercial market is then going to lead to advertising and marketing and celebrity sponsorships and many of the strategies that we have seen used by the tobacco industry in the past.
So Lewis says this is not the time to do it. He joins a chorus of other public officials, including Governor Baker, Mayor Marty Walsh, Attorney General Maura Healey. Lewis says it's the wrong time for the state to go down this road. Is he right, John? What do you think?
Well, I think you can look to other states. You can look to Colorado, which has pretty effectively implemented a recreational marijuana law. And they have very tight security. I mean, they have radio identifiers, RFID chips in the seeds. They track the seeds all the way to harvesting. They videotape every step of the way. They have basically initiated a system that seems to be working pretty well for them. I think one of the things that's overlooked is that the legislature has this initiative until May 3rd. They could actually pass a law that they could tailor in a way that that might overcome some of these objections. I doubt very much that they're going to take any action. So it'll get more signatures. It'll likely go to the ballot. So I think that there are all kinds of pitfalls. And one of the big issues is the taxation. The taxation could be between 10 and 12%. this committee that Representative Lewis or Senator Lewis headed up said the tax money probably will not cover the public and social costs of this initiative, from health care to regulation to policing. So that's another issue. If people think we're going to make a lot of money in this state because of this, it's probably not going to turn out that way.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up Colorado. And Tom, I want to get your response. But first, listen to this. This is Andrew Friedman. He's the director of marijuana coordination for the state of Colorado, which legalized recreational pot in 2012. We spoke to him this week. He said that the experiment has worked out, their legalization has worked out pretty well, that the worst fears haven't come to pass. But he also had some concerns. So here's one of the concerns that he raised about Colorado.
I worry as the industry starts to consolidate over time, as industry members get kind of more access to nuanced data, that they start to learn how to get people more addicted and how to get people addicted at a younger age, that's a possible path forward that I think we're going to have to work really hard to make sure that's not what Colorado looks like.
So, and that's actually an argument that Senator Jason Lewis agreed with. But Tom, what are you hearing in this debate pre-possible referendum question here in Massachusetts?
So what's striking to me is that is sort of almost how monolithically the political establishment has lined up against the legalization of marijuana, which, by the way, also happened pretty much with medical marijuana a few years ago. And yet, if you look at the polling, clearly at this point, and it could change, but clearly at this point, a majority of Massachusetts voters would vote to pass this particular referendum. And, you know, it can't help but kind of think that you have this kind of establishment versus the people kind of thing that we're seeing play out in the presidential race, both in terms of Sanders and in terms of Trump. And we may see a little bit like that, where the good people of Massachusetts really reject the advice of their political elders, if you will.
And it's spurred the entrepreneurial spirit to some degree here in Massachusetts. A woman named Holly Alberti, who's a Mass native, is preparing a startup called Healthy Heady Lifestyle. And she's calling it the Mary Kay for Mary J. And she would bring samples, cannabis samples, to people's homes so that they could try them out and decide what they wanted to do. So I think, you know, there are some certainly entrepreneurial upsides to this.
It seems like, let me just get you both to respond really quickly to this idea. I mean, it seems like we're moving in this direction eventually, and whether it's by referendum or getting there eventually at some other point, shouldn't the state find a way to sort of jump into this game and safely regulate this, pass legislation that regulates it? What do you think, Tom?
So I think that politicians very rarely want to take this initiative because they feel they can only be punished for it. So it's really easy to oppose it. I think you're absolutely right. We're going to go in that direction. Eventually, it's going to pass, and I think it probably should. If you listen to the arguments against marijuana, those are the same arguments that could be made against alcohol, and indeed they once were about a century ago. You the same arguments that, quite frankly, in terms of tailoring and figuring out how people, you know, why they buy and don't buy, with the same arguments about the cigarette manufacturers, same arguments about gambling, you know, legalized gambling, including casino gambling. But eventually we're going to get there. And I really do think that, kind of as it happened in Colorado, smart regulation can do a lot to minimize the harms that are going to be out there.
They could go so far as to set up a state-run marijuana shops, the way they have state liquor stores up in New Hampshire. I think that that's probably not the way they're going to go. One last thing. You know, federal law still outlaws marijuana. So you're always going to have this clash between the state and the feds, and that's going to be a stumbling block going forward, too.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I don't want to let you guys go before we talk a little bit about Cuba, because this was a story that was of such historic importance. President Obama's historic trip to Cuba this week, a major effort at reconciliation between these two countries. So here he is addressing the Cuban people as the first president to visit the country since 1928. Here's a little bit of that.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
Yeah.
I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
So, Tom Keene, I mean, all three of us in this room, I mean, this Cuban-American isolation has just been part of the wallpaper of this world for our entire lives, pretty much.
Absolutely.
I found this story so moving and extra sad about how the Brussels tragedy sort of buried it.
I think that's exactly right. It's plainly a policy that has failed. It is also a policy that is completely inconsistent in terms of our policy with engaging a number of other states that have dictatorial or communist governments. China, Vietnam, in terms of dictatorial and monarchical of all throughout the Middle East, we have always found that engagement works better. And I think we're going to find that engagement works better. And our insistence that somehow Cuba had to become democratic and non-communist before we talked to them was, I think, a crazy policy that actually simply kept the current regime in place.
Hmm. John, your thoughts?
Well, it wasn't exactly a pajama party down there. I think that that there was some real awkwardness and some real uncomfortable moments for both sides. I think that the rap against the U.S. is that they gave up a lot more than Cuba did in terms of having this rapprochement. But I think that that both Barack Obama and Raul Castro are both looking to their legacies, looking to try to fashion some kind of lasting impact. And I think that Raul Castro has been a reformer to some degree in that, you know, with sort of China-style reforms in Cuba. So, and I think that opened the door, too, as well, to sort of ease the tension a little bit and give an opening to Obama, which he took. Neither side got everything they wanted, but both sides got something out of it.
All right. Well, let's move on to our hubbubs, those brief stories that might not have made it to the top of the news this week, but caught your attention. Tom, let's start with you.
Well, okay, the first game of the 2016 baseball season is April 3rd, just a week from now. And quite frankly, in the midst of everything that's going on, including everything we've been talking about in terms of terrorism and the presidential campaign and so on, this season can't come soon enough.
Hear, hear.
Baseball, you know, baseball is still America's pastime. It's Boston's love. It gives rhythm to the days that we don't get from any other sport. I think of baseball as kind of the comfort food of the sports world. And I'm not saying the game makes the world all right. We saw that in 2013 with the marathon bombings. But I am saying that somehow baseball gives a sense that maybe the world could be all right.
All right. And maybe the Red Sox will be all right. What do you think?
I think there's a chance here.
David Price and pray for rain, right?
Price and let's hope something happens with Sandoval.
Okay. John, your hubbub.
My hubbub has to do with something that's never all right, and that's the MBTA, which is the region's public transit system, not to be confused with a rapid transit system. they've always had a problem on the Green Line above ground with collecting fares. And for a period of time, they didn't collect fares above ground. They have been recently. And it's difficult because if they only open the front door for exit and entrance, you know, they've tried that. That went over like the metric system because you can walk faster than taking the T at that point. So they've abandoned that. But what they instituted this past weekend was an announcement on the trains at every stop above ground for the Green Line with a woman's voice saying, pay your fare. It's only fair. And that was crazy-making for the drivers, for the riders, and apparently for the people who live around the stations because they kicked up a tweet storm. I'll just read two. Pay your fare, it's only fair, needs to be re-recorded as improve your service, it's only fair. Because, I mean, really. And then the other one was, I can hear the train screaming, pay your fare from my apartment. Kill me at MBTA. So they have killed it, actually. It lasted all of 5 days. They discontinued it. So it's now safe to sneak on the T the way it was before.
All right. Well, my hubbub comes from universalhub.com and is about what happens when academic pressure meets our hyper-litigious society. So check this out. You'd think that most students would be pleased by their professor's decision not to give them a final exam. But not Sonny Vilbon, a student in BU's master program. When his professor said that there'd be no final exam, Vilbon sued him, arguing breach of contract under the state's consumer protection laws because the course syllabus mentioned a final exam. Vilbon wanted to take the exam so he could raise his GPA high enough to graduate. But sadly for him, the Massachusetts Appeals Court dismissed the lawsuit, sided with a Superior Court judge that ruled that a syllabus is not a contract and that the professor did not violate the state's consumer protection law. So there you go.
Be careful with those syllabi, huh?
There you go.
And there'll be a test at the end for everyone listening.
All right, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti's Idea and Opinion page. Tom, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And John Carroll, WBUR Senior Media Analyst and Professor of Communication at BU. John, you too. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.